Welcome to the Mixtape with Scott. I'm the host, Scott Cunningham, professor of economics at Baylor University. And in this week's episode, I had the honor of interviewing famed applied microeconomist, Dr. Richard Blundell. Dr. Richard Blundell is the David Ricardo Professor of Political Economy at the University of College London, or UCL. Dr. Blundell has made many seminal contributions to a range of areas in economics, including microeconometrics with panel data, labor economics as field, and public economics. He's, to many, a real legend. He's a very productive man, filled with an interesting life story that I thought many of you would find interesting also. As always, as you know, I hope that these stories are useful for you as you listen without judgment. And just hear Dr. Blundell tell bits and pieces of his life story. I continue to believe that when we are successful with navigating our lives, one of the things that helps is friendships. One of the things that helps is family. One of the things that helps is our own mental toughness. But one of the things that also helps is the stories of other people. And as you've heard me say, I think in professions and careers of science and commerce, and in economics in general, it's the stories of people's personal lives that helps a lot. No matter how different people seem from us, the oxygen that we need for breathing underwater, I think lots of times comes from hearing anybody's story, listening closely, having consideration towards people. Lots of times is not really so-called being kind, but just being present and allowing their story to affect you. What we learn when that happens is that people are marvelous. In the process of losing sight of ourselves, I think our own heavy weights can sort of drift away. We realize that we're all connected, not so different from one another at all. When we're close, we can sometimes even hear, for reasons that are hard to explain, hear our own stories too. So thank you for Dr. Blundell for sitting down with me. And I'm going to turn it over to me, myself and I, sitting down to talk with the David Ricardo Professor of Political Economy at UCL, Richard Blundell.
Well, this is a pleasure to meet someone that I've only read, and this is our first time to actually talk, I think so. This is Dr. Richard Blundell at UCL. Thank you so much for being on the show.
My pleasure, Scott.
Can you, for the sake of the listener, will you say your full title? And I don't think I pronounced your name correctly. Your full title and where you work.
Yeah, okay. I'm Richard Blundell. I'm a professor of economics at UCL, and I'm also a research fellow at the Institute of Fiscal Studies. They're two different places which I've been associated a long time.
Oh, okay. All right, that's cool. I'll ask about that later. Well, before we get started, let's do an icebreaker. What's a vacation that you took maybe as a kid or as a young person that, you know, it may not have been your favorite vacation, but it was something that every now and then you still think about?
Oh, good question. There are many, many of those, but let me pick on a road trip while I was an undergraduate. So I think of still young, in the early 70s, around Southern Europe, which was very different. It was kind of a great experience, because remember, Spain was a dictatorship, Portugal was a dictatorship, Greece was a dictatorship. And in those days, you know, we didn't do internships or anything. As soon as classes were done, we got an old car together and drove as far south as possible. And it was pretty impressive and impressed me. I think it was the first time I'd really fallen in love with the whole of Europe. We drove right from Greece, right through the whole of Southern Europe, all the way up to Portugal. And so that's one thing. So that's the good thing. The other thing was, you know, it cemented my my distaste for authoritarian regimes.
Predicting.
And at the time, everywhere I went, people of my age were getting ready for the revolution. And I thought, of course, they were highly optimistic, but within about 3 years, in every one of those countries, they'd all turned over to democracy, which was impressive. And I've never really forgotten that. And of course, the 50 years that followed have been quite impressive in that sense too, across Europe.
I bet that's cast a big shadow over you then. That experience sounds pretty profound.
Yeah, I think so. It since then, I've always loved traveling. I've liked the interaction of, politics and life. Also realize you like a place even if it's under authoritarianism, but you might prefer not to be there, and you can see how it might be improved. And those places have come, economically, socially, in every way, they've really moved, and it's been an exciting era, I think. And so, yeah, that has had a long-term effect on the way I think.
The only thing we have in comparison in the United States is the slavery experience and the race relations, because I grew up in the South. And so in the South is I wouldn't say, I mean, I love the South because it's my home, but I wouldn't say when I drove by Mississippi that I think, oh wow, it's just a thriving, thriving economy. But I mean, I guess that's the we that's the difference, partly the difference between US and the and Europe is just this so much diversity of these countries. It's so neat.
Well, whenever I've traveled around the US, I realize it's difficult to describe it as one single
That's
country.
true.
It's many.
That's true. It's very crazy. That's right. We'll see how many there are this fall when we vote. Well,
Exactly.
so tell me where you grew up. Where did you grow up?
I grew up on the south coast of the UK, in near a town called Brighton. Which is a is was a pretty good place to grow up, right near the beach. A lot
A
of
famous poem or something about Brighton? Lord Byron?
Brighton. Well, there's a famous book, Brighton Rock, which
Oh,
Graham
Brighton
Greene wrote.
Rock.
It's a cool place to grow up, in fact, because there was the as a teenager, there's the excitement of the 60s. There's
Oh, yeah.
famously the rocks rockers the mods and rockers had their battles on the street fronts of Brighton. So you either drove a Lambretta or you drove a Triumph. Actually, over that period, I had both a Lambretta and a Triumph. So
Oh,
maybe this
wow. Triumph,
characterizes me. I don't
Triumph
go to,
motorcycle. Yeah, the Triumph
yeah,
motorcycle.
Triumph 350. Yeah,
Oh,
exactly.
yeah. I mean, that's beautiful. That's
Yeah.
beautiful. You still drive one of those into the office now?
I cycle into the office now.
Cycle, you did. You went in a different direction.
That's right.
Wait, so when you were younger, so where were you in relations to the Rolling Stones and the Beatles and that emerging music?
Yeah.
You're
Well,
younger?
yeah, I'm younger than them by quite a bit, really. So I'm 70, coming up to 72 there,
Oh, okay.
nearly 10 years older. But they were highly influential, that of course they were highly influential. And at that time, of course, music was everything, and it was everything to me. So we all wanted to be rock and roll stars.
So what did your parents do for a living?
Yeah, they were from that generation. They left school at 14. They were pretty smart, and lots of books and lots of a great upbringing, but no, very little education. That's not uncommon from that generation. Remember, the UK was highly uneducated. Even when I went to university, there would be around 10% of people going to university or less, in fact, and mainly from the upper echelons of society. So the move to what it is now, which is around 50%, has been very dramatic. And it happened much later. As it's happened across Europe, happened much later than in the US, which is a kind of interesting feature of what's happened. So that was That so not much kind of direction in terms of education and academia, but a lot of interest in discussion and those kinds of things.
Were you a bit of an outlier going to college, even amongst your
Yeah,
peers?
my brother also went to college, so we're not outliers. We're outliers relative to everything else, but we both did, the college thing. In fact, he's a professor at Cambridge, and I'm a professor here, so it worked out fine for us. But
Right.
it was not our expectation to go to college. It worked out that way, and it was, in fact, when I was at school, I went to college as an engineer. In fact,
Oh.
as a sound engineer, because I wanted to do acoustic engineering, because I wanted to redesign music venues, so
Oh, really? So music's in
that's
your
the
bones.
influence of Brighton. Economics came much later.
That was a plan B. Wait, so
Exactly.
music's really been in your bones for a long time.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
Oh,
that's,
huh.
yeah, no, it's important.
What were
It
you
becomes,
listening?
go
Go
on.
ahead.
No, it's good. If you're an academic, you need something else, I think,
Yes,
to
that's
survive.
right.
And
Right.
as you know, and many people you've interviewed, I'm sure, have something else that really keeps them,
Yeah.
sane. And music does that. Always done that for me.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's. Sorry, go ahead.
No,
Well,
you
so
go.
in high school, what were the bands that you were listening to?
Yeah, they were, both sides of the Atlantic. It was the 60s, so it's going to be Beatles and Stones and Kinks and all that here. And whether it was Dylan and follow-ups,
Oh.
Jeff Sayre playing all those. I should say that I've got this very strong kind of jazz and folk interest too. So I grew up partly listening to Coltrane and all those people, Miles
Oh.
Davis, partly from that's what we did in our family.
That was even how your parents were? Even your parents
He's
were like that?
more my brother, but yeah, music was important to us, so it always
Wow.
has been. So
That's
that's
great. Yeah. Did you play any instruments?
I had a band.
Oh, you had a band?
Maybe you don't want to go into that. It's
Oh, no,
certainly,
that's what we got. I want to
as you
hear a little
know,
bit about that. But what was it?
I'm
What kind of band did you have? What did you play in the band?
I play guitar and saxophone, actually. So I
Oh.
flip between both of those. As you can imagine, I'm Ricardo Professor here. I've realized the point of comparative advantage, and in that sense, it was good to stay as my hobby and not my living. But of course, I play guitar, still do,
Oh,
and
that's great.
it's a lot of fun. Yeah, in those guys, when you're a kid, you can spend a lot of time doing that. You spend hours and hours playing music with friends. And at college, we had a great band, actually. So
Oh, that's
that
great. And that was
was
in Brighton. That was in
that
Brighton.
was in Bristol. I went
That
to
was
the
in
University
Bristol.
of
So that was a
Bristol.
college band.
College band. That's right.
Okay.
That was when it really took off. Bristol was famous, still is, for engineering, so I went there as an engineer. I came out as an economist, but that's
Yeah. Was it one of
that
those
kind of
things
thing
where in high
happens.
school? Was it one of those things in high school where you had to pick engineering in high school and that's why you went that route?
Not quite, but there was no, in those days, that's true, right? Probably in the US too, there was no economics in high school at a high level, so if you did math and physics and chemistry and things
It
like
was
that, which of
engineering.
course I did, you specialize, and acoustic engineering took my liking. So but basically it's kind of physics and engineering. But it did, it was good, but it didn't fully appeal to me when I got there.
When
So
you got there,
I
when you
started.
started taking the classes, acoustic engineering wasn't doing
That's right.
anything.
Yeah. Well, like many undergraduates, and I'm sure it happens here, I got there, and the actual acoustic engineering part of the engineering was closed for the year, because I guess the guy was on sabbatical. I'm sure that happened to everyone.
It was one
But
guy.
I didn't like that at all. So
The other parts, yeah.
and you can move around those things. In fact, I think in a bar I met someone who was doing economics. It sounded pretty good, and that's the way I get. I should say that guy who persuaded me to do economics ended up switching to dentistry. So, which is pretty weird. As I tell people, some people find pulling teeth more fun than economics. So,
Found him at the right time, though. If you had found him a
for
year
me,
later, you might be a
exactly.
dentist. Okay, so he's the influence. He's the natural experiment that finds
It's
you.
kind of true. It's kind of true. Yeah, that's right. Although one thing at Bristol that was good, not that it's particularly relevant, but it was a brilliant group of statisticians. So the degree there was economics and statistics, which is where the econometrics come from. And it was very easy if you were good at math to get into that course. And that was terrific.
There was econometrics there. You were starting to see this interest in econometrics as a college student.
I think statistics, yeah, and economics, the combination. There was some econometrics, but it was more, distributions. There's a guy, famous guy there, Keith Ord, who's a brilliant statistician, actually wrote a book called Families of Distributions. And I thought that was brilliant. So just thinking through distributions, and those kind of things influence you a long time, the things you then, now I can look at, I can think as through different distributions quite easily. And that's kind of handy if you're doing any kind of econometrics, actually. So that was very helpful. Yeah, exactly.
So the what are the econ classes? Was it labor? Did the labor classes catch you when you were an undergrad?
I
I mean, I
wouldn't
say that
say
because you go into labor in public.
No, that comes later after yeah, because I went it's true, undergraduate here is you specialize very quickly, so I'm doing a lot of economics, but it's largely econometric statistics, micro. I quite like micro theory at that time,
You did,
and
okay.
so that's that was pretty good. Enough to get me into do the master's at LSE, which is if you talk to anyone who's of my generation or younger, you'll find that was a very influential master's. It still is, but the master's in econometrics and math econ was like a pretty high level, bit like a PhD courses would be now, and that was highly influential. So that's
What were the
important.
classes, what were the econometrics professors that made a big influence on you at LSE?
Yeah, that would be LSE. So the main influence is a guy you might have heard from, a very fine economist, Irish, and a character called Terence Gorman. You may not have heard of him, but he was someone who wrote about consumer theory and empirical work on consumers. So he's the guy who kind of, let's say, invented separability, weak separability, all these things that you use in consumer decision making, which I found incredibly interesting, actually. So and squared up with empirical analysis of what people do. So he was, and he's a great character. A wonderful character. So I think he interviewed me, and I got to know him extremely well. Fine Irish character. Then
He's still alive right
no,
now.
he passed. He passed, 20 years ago. In fact, when I came to UCL, I got him to. It was pretty fledgling group we had here, so I got it. He was at Oxford by then, and he would come in 2 or 3 days a week, actually, and he was very influential on the group of colleagues and the group we built here. So in fact, we have our annual lecture here is called the Gorman Lecture, and it's all about tribute to him, really, and the way it affected. In those days, remember, in the UK, microeconometrics and empirical micro was kind of unusual. It's a little bit less so than it would have been in the US, and even in the US, in the mid Mid-70s, that would have been still fairly unusual because access to data was so poor. And
Right.
but you know, you're coming up to the first micro data revolution where you get suddenly get access to fantastic panel data and cross-section data, the pre-admin and administrative register data. But the first wave, which was a fantastic the important way actually is where all the panel data work came out, and you know, there was a lot of excitement there. So there was a guy there, a young guy called Steve Nichol, who's not so young, he's older than me. He's a well-known labor economist and econometrician, and he taught, I think it was his first job at LSE, so he was also influential. It was a great group, by the way. There's Saga and there's Durbin of Durbin Watson Test, you know, they're all on the faculty there. So that was the things you learn, you know, you don't realize it at the time, but the things you get out there, you keep, you know, and I can still do
It
all
was
that
a
stuff.
lot of econometrics for a master's program. LSE was very, wow. How many years?
You could focus. Remember, it was called Econometrics and Math Econ, so you'd have a set like Franca and, you know, all the guys in Math Econ. If you wanted to do that, you know, it's where I picked up duality theory from Gorman and that, which also is very influential. But apart from duality and thinking about decision making, it was more the econometrics. Yeah, it is a terrific background. Yeah,
Well,
absolutely.
so am I wrong that I couldn't find a PhD? Did you do a PhD?
No, I didn't. It
You
was.
didn't. You went straight from the Master's of Science to a job at
Well, it was a good master, by the way.
It was a good
It
master.
wasn't so unusual, but I, so
Oh.
Gorman, you know, the guy I've just told you I loved and influential, Gorman, actually wanted to supervise me. But one characteristic of Gorman was brilliance but disorganization. And I realized after sitting in Lincoln's Inn Fields, I think, you know, talking about work, which we love, we did a lot of stuff together. I thought, no, this is not going to work as a PhD. So you could move into jobs at that time. So I took a job in Manchester, which I think it was the third, I think I was interviewed at York, Warwick, and Manchester, and third time lucky, you know, but I was a youngster,
So you went to
20.
Manchester as a faculty member.
I did, yeah, as a lecturer in econometrics, as econometrics in those days, departments. I didn't think that was a good idea, by the way, but they had separate econometrics departments from economics departments. Indeed, at LSE too. That changed, and I think that was a change for the good, but much more integrated these days. Well, hopefully they are. But it was a separate. There was a guy, if you've ever come across Johnson's Econometrics, Jack Johnson. It's a book from the 70s. You may have come across Econometric Methods, I think. It's a little inferior to Goldberg, to Arthur's, Art Goldberger's book of similar time, which I preferred. But you know, Johnson's book was a very popular one and pretty good. He was a great guy, so he was the kind of chair of econometrics there. But I must say, when I got there, he thought the UK was turning to socialism and decided he should leave for North America. I even at that point I said, you know, I don't really see this, and it turned out I was right because, you know, a year later Thatcher was elected, which was hardly a move to socialism. But a few people left at that time, and a few people left after Thatcher was elected too. But that was a good experience. You know, sometimes doing things on your own is pretty good. And remember, there wasn't too much microeconometrics. So, you know, I'm drawing off, you know, McFadden, Jim Heckman, Jerry, all those guys that were very influential in the early days of microeconometrics, and people here too. And you know, you might as well just draw on it yourself as much as do a PhD. I wouldn't recommend people not do a PhD anymore, but you know, there are other ways of learning stuff, and it was fun to do it that way at the time.
So you leave LSE about 75, is that right? And that's when you start at Manchester. You start at Manchester. You
23
go
years old.
3 years old. Wow. And so, straight out with a master's, it's just that LSE is essentially pushed a doctorate almost into that master's, pretty much,
Yeah, the
right?
course, even now, the course is at a good doctorate, like the one we got here or at LSE, or, it's pretty much at that level. There was
Right.
probably a little less real analysis and maybe some other, things you would get now. There was less game theory then, but that's more history. That's more history of how things have developed rather than the content. So it was pretty rigorous. It was good.
Well, I was going to ask that. Now this is an awkward question because I don't know how to ask it, but I was going to say, well, what was your education like at LSE compared to the kinds of education you've overseen at UCL or other places? But it's like, one's a doctorate, one's a master's, but still, what was different about it that people would be surprised about?
Well, remember here, everybody does a master's before a doctorate, so it's not so, that was true then, and many people left, the master's I was on would have gone to the US for a PhD or stayed around in the UK for a PhD. But there are plenty of people, certainly a few years old ahead of me, who didn't do PhDs at all. Steve Nichol, for example, my colleague Andrew Cheshire, the econometrician, I think he was hired straight out of a BSc, not even a master's, and he's a pretty smart guy. So, but masters have kind of dominated the scene in the UK. It's almost at one point we cornered the market, I think you could say. So a master's from LSE, from the MPhil at Oxford, the MSc here at UCL was really still are booming, by the way, and there are this huge number of students on them, and they're a great source of interacting with students and developing students. So you'll get hundreds of students on these courses, and then a small group will go on to a PhD, maybe 20 or 30 of them out of 100, say. And so it's a kind of pre-way into a doctorate. It works. I still think it works pretty good. I always remember being surprised that, people in the US were going straight into a doctorate out of a BSc or BA. And of course, now it would be typical not to do that and to do some pre-doc or something like that, or some internship. And I think there's a little bit of maturity before you start a PhD is not a bad idea.
Well, so when do you get these interests in labor and public finance? Was it at LSE or does it happen later? Because I guess you graduate as an you're like an actual econ a microeconometrician, but you already are an applied econometrician focusing on, because you mentioned Heckman, you're focused on labor.
Not just labor. So I've always I think I've always been more interested in just the word household behavior, actually. And so that interacts with labor, it interacts with public finance, and it interacts with a whole set of things
All set
around
of things.
studying families, dynamics, all those things. So I kind of like that. I was drawing off, people doing discrete choice, people doing panel data dynamics, all those things all came together. Then And so it was, I never think of myself as a labor economist. I think I do labor economics, but I also look at public finance and econometrics. And at that time, it was pretty, I mean, the intersection was pretty exciting, I should say, and I think it has stayed that way. But particularly in those days, we were coming across our first sets of real panel data, being able to study dynamic behavior of households, labor markets, all those things. And in some sense, there were a lot of a lot of low hanging fruit to be picked, and we all picked at them.
So what were some low-hanging fruit back then that like, and why were they like, top of mind for somebody interested in consumer theory
It was
or household behavior?
good question. I think the we were at the beginnings of dealing with heterogeneity properly in econometrics and study. Remember, up to that point, everything was cross-section, and a lot of the low-hanging fruit was in that. You know, how do you've got a cross-section. This is going to sound a bit boring, but you've got a cross-section and you want to think dynamics. How do you do that? So, you know, one of the first things that I did was, you know, can you kind of use, can you use some ideas from theory to condition on some outcomes to get things that are consistent with dynamic behavior, even if you're just looking at cross-section, so that all that life cycle consistent or conditioning on savings. So are the variables that you think are going to summarize the future kind of well? And now that sounds simple these days, but it was an innovation, and it was kind of easy to publish that type of work at the time because it was new. And there was, you know, plenty of interest, whether it was on investment or consumer behavior over time, just how to think about dynamics generally. You know, if we have a tax reform, then how do people, how does the evolution of behavior follow, whether it's investment of firms or labor demand? Or consumer behavior. So that kind of drew me in to thinking public finance. You know, the big policy concerns at that time were, as they I think should be and still are, around the bottom of the distribution and how you deal with inequality. And so that stayed with me all the time.
It must be really exciting to have the, did you say you have the Ricardo chair?
Yeah.
That's gotta
The
be amazing.
oldest champion. It's the oldest chair of economics in England because we're the oldest. I can't say the UK because we're beaten by Glasgow, which of course has the famous
Adam
Adam
Smith.
Smith. But
Sure.
in England, in fact, we're coming up for 200 years. It was, I think it was. So what happened was Ricardo was a brilliant person and a brilliant economist, and you know, he founded the Stock Exchange in London, apart from many other things. And he died relatively young, and he founded, he left some money to found the department here. And
Oh.
it was Bentham, who then, Bentham was the founder of UCL, of course, and 200 years ago. And what happened was he went around asking people, you know, is this a good idea? There's some great letters. I've got one where he's writing to Say. Say was a very
My
famous
gosh.
French economist. And he says, you know, my dear Say, my dear Professor Say, do you think it's a good idea that we have a chair of a political economy? Of course, it was called then because that was the field, a chair of political economy at UCL. And he writes back saying, bravo, this is a wonderful idea, my dear Bentham. And that was, and then he had the money from Ricardo to found it, and that's where it started. And
Well, I
so
was just
it's a great chair to have, you know,
that's a great chair to have. And you know, his I don't have it in front of me, but like he's got this opening paragraph for the Principles of Political Economy, and it's basically like it's something about the just essentially that the work that the most important work is to understand the rules that govern the allocation of the resources that come from the land and all this stuff. And it's, you know, public finance. And then you're in public finance and you're got Ricardo's chair. It just must be really
It's
surreal.
good. No, it's cool. And it's a great economy. I remember, I think there's some quote where I think Dave Donaldson actually has it in his paper on comparative advantage, where Sam Paul Samuelson's you know, saying, what give me, you know, someone's asking Samuelson, what's the biggest great idea in economics? And he says, comparative
Comparative
advantage. You know,
advantage. Yeah, that's great.
of course, it's easy to say, it's quite difficult to prove the importance of comparative advantage. I think it took another 150 years for anyone to do that empirically, but the idea is good.
It's good. So you know, I recently wrote this history of Diff and Diff, and it was Difference and Differences. And it was a not really like a history per se, as it was more like, you know, what was the evolution of the papers? I was trying to sort of try to understand the evolution of the papers. And I used Google Scholar, and I was using, when does diff and def appear with certain words like parallel
Oh,
trends
yeah.
or event
Yeah.
study. And what was really interesting in doing this was seeing how often you came up in this like history. Like for instance, you've got this paper with you have these two papers with Monica Costa
Sure.
Diaz,
Yeah, of course.
evaluation methods for non-experimental data, alternative approaches to evaluation in empirical micro.
That's right.
And I was like looking at it, and I just was wondering when you become this maybe proponent's not the right word, but you become this like spokesman almost of explaining the evaluation methods for non-experimental data, and almost seem ahead of your time. I mean, obviously it's like coming out of Princeton and Harvard and stuff, but it's like, you're sort of bringing it and really being very careful in the econometrics and writing down what assumptions are going to be used for this difference in differences and having very influential work. And I just was curious. I wouldn't associate that you said earlier, that you were reading a lot of McFadden when you were in grad school. So I wouldn't associate that with this kind of empirical labor. So I just was curious what was all that about for you?
Yeah, a good question. Well, I've never been religious about methods, as you probably realize, because and I, you know, and I like answering questions, not trying to figure out something without a question first. So, and you know, for lots of questions, that kind of analysis is what you want to do. You do it automatically. So I think the way I was getting it when I wrote those papers was just for me and with students. I mean, that was a course to begin with. I've written a lot where we were using, you know, if you are going to want to build a structural model for counterfactuals, you can't do counterfactuals without a structural model, but you want to make sure it all fits as best you can with a set of policy reforms you've seen. Then the cleanest thing to do is to figure out some kind of quasi-experimental method, and diff and diff was the diff and diff's been around a long time. I do attribute it though to, to Orley and David Card. And Orley was also, I got this job when I got this job at UCL. I was visiting Princeton, and I got the call about a job at UCL and come over. So I came over immediately for, in those days, that interview is not seminars, so they do it with the provost, and that's the way, the bizarre old way that we do it here. We've got better since then, but yeah, I was sitting in a seminar. I remember that well, actually, because I was sitting in a seminar. It was Orley and Angus. David was still, I think he was just finishing his PhD.
So it's
Does
like,
that
yeah,
make
like
sense? Yeah, I think
early,
it might make
early
sense.
'70s.
Or maybe on there is a young, Whitney was a young faculty member, Whitney Newing. I'm going to get some of this wrong, so, but it, largely right. And so it already, I learned a lot from Orley and David and the Princeton group. I've always mixed and matched. In fact, I never really, some people get driven by argument and rivalry. I kind of like putting things together, and I know there's plenty of people that like are driven to creativity by, arguing and going one tribe or another, but that's never been my motivation. So right from early on, I was interested in how you might use these methods, and diff and diff is incredibly powerful because in fact, I remember Richard Freeman, David and I did a little book, actually. It was part of a kind of review called How to Make Britain a Premier Economy. So we went around talking to people about what policies. This is at the late 90s, and from that I realized that, if you want to explain something clearly and get over a point, diff and diff is
Different diff.
beautiful. Of course, My view is it's much harder to in it's really hard to come up with an environment when it really works well, and we've seen this explosion of new papers taking it much further. And generally that's true, but if you're trying to convince somebody that some policy is really having an impact, we're talking about a time when often it was just time series, and that of course gets you nowhere. So at least having the time series of a comparative group and arguing for viral trends and that, yeah, I thought it was convincing. And I've always tried to get people to look at all these things and choose the one that's most appropriate for their question. And still do that, Scott. That's the way I think. Can't get it.
This paper with Stephen Bond on initial conditions and moment
Oh,
restrictions,
yeah.
it
Yes.
has
Right.
30,000 sites since it was published in 98, which is amazing. And I'm just curious if you would just share a little bit about what that paper's about, but also how was that paper born? What was the origin story of that paper?
So this is about the microgroup that we was it was a very exciting time. The early You're talking about late 80s and early 90s. That paper came out in 98, but in fact the work was done in the early 90s. And the that was the time it was we had access through the Institute of Fiscal Studies, where policy and empirical policy work is the kind of key. And we had just founded the research group there, and we got a big amount of money to have a center in public empirical analysis, public policy, really, you could say. And so there was a lot of interest in that, and I had two or three very talented people around. There was Manuel Arellano, who has just finished his PhD at LSE, I think he was at Oxford. Steve, his first job, Steve Bond, was at IFS. And Costas McGeer, actually, and a few others were all around. We were all looking at aspects of panel data. And it was as simple as this, because what happened was as the natural thing, if you've got the two absolutely kind of key things that drive endogeneity, and when we're thinking about it, you've got individual heterogeneity and correlation there, and you've got correlated transitory shocks or current period simultaneity. So how are you going to deal with that? Everybody's answer, if you look back at that era, including Stephen Manuel's and a lot of us, was the difference, because we've got panel data. That's the transformation that gets out. The problem with differencing, and then of course you want to deal with endogeneity, so you're going to find an instrument. The problem with differencing is many things have approximately unit root and they're very hard to predict. And so the first stage on trying to get an instrument to predict a difference has usually got extremely low power. And in fact, what we found was, we were getting a lot of a kind of finite sample bias, you could say, just a lot of small sample bias, even from consistent estimated, broadly speaking, coming from weak instruments, just not enough. The argument there was, the instruments we're using often were lags. A lot of people don't like using lags as instruments, but a lot of the time you're thinking, I've differenced out the individual effect. What's left is is the shocks that are hitting the process, but they've got some kind of limited dependence. And of course, if that's true, that's always true in some theory, and many people, but broadly speaking, it's going to be fine. And so under some transformation, history of different things, including policies, of course, can be good instruments. But if the thing is a it's a random walk, it's hard to predict. So it's that kind of idea. And then we kind of got that paper was in one afternoon. We said, surely there's something else we can do. So we started with stationarity, and then with stationarity you get more moments. And a lot of those moments looked like you were still using the level of the model, but you were using things like differences as instruments. So, and the application, the first application was production function, and bizarrely, it's still often used for production functions, because there, heterogeneity is key. You think there's some unobservable unobservable technical change causing shock. So, you know, you want to do both these. You want to get rid of the heterogeneity, the level heterogeneity if you want, and you want to get rid of the simultaneity that's coming from the concurrent technological shocks you're not seeing. That's obviously going to be correlated with labor and capital choices. So, you know, that's where you think of, you know, what transformations can I do where I still get some powerful powerful GMM or IV type results. You know, what moments are I going to use? And it all came down to, well, you know, if you make enough conditions on the initial condition, you can get these things to work. Stationarity is one, you can be weaker than that. And a fairly weak conditions, and then suddenly you get much more robust, powerful results. And they're quite powerful, even if the process is getting close to a unit root, they can give you much more precision. So that caught on. I mean, we literally, you know, you can never tell what's going to be a successful paper in my book. That was an idea developed over time, but put together one afternoon at IFS, and it's been very successful.
How did you
get citations?
It's been incredible. I mean, when did you first notice that it was being impactful? Did you notice you were working on it for many years?
Yeah. Well, so, one thing that's been picked up by many people, because remember, in that, you know, investment models, consumption models, but particularly investment models and production functions were being, you know, there's a lot of data out there where people were trying to figure those things out. And suddenly, thanks partly to Steve Bond writing this up in Gauss, which was what everybody used, or, you know, there was a program there, which of course there's many in Stata now, and are, I think. But people would use it. And so right early on in the, you know, by the mid 90s, there was, late 90s, the ideas were being used a lot and we were getting a lot of citations even then. What's been remarkable is that they've just, you know, it's stayed reasonably influential, and that's a nice thing to see, of course.
That's incredible. That must feel, how does that feel to think about that, you know, one day, but also many years has turned out to just been so valuable to so many people and so impactful.
It's good. I mean, one thing, so recently you might have seen I'm going to say that. So it Journal of Econometrics did this, you know, 50th anniversary, and they picked the most cited paper of each of a decade, and ours was the most cited paper in the 90s. So we just look back on it, we kind of republished and then did a little think through what it's done. And one thing that really surprised me, I didn't realize this, it's used a lot outside regular economics. So you see it, a lot of citations in a much broader literature, in, you know, right across all kinds of literature, in kind of management, in right across kind of business, finance, and even other parts of social science. So that's also a kind of interesting thing. I think if you are lucky enough to get a method that people pick up on, then it's like a gold mine, really. And it's nice to see.
Well, did it change your life, do you think, at all? Did it change your career? Made you switch what kinds of topics you worked on or anything like that?
Not really, no.
Not really?
I work on, you know, the things I know, which is, you know, trying to figure out, you know, behavior and what parameters we need to make, you know, to get public policy working better. And, you know, so that's just one part of the microeconometric toolbox, I guess, which is continues to be developed in a pretty exciting way, I think. I mean, it's still, as you're great, you know, the work you've done is really important. It's still very influential, and I think it's made economics a more precise, better, and it's great. Yeah. So now I flip between methods, because as you probably know, I think that it's important to have the full structural dynamic model sitting there, because I want to look at some Tax policy and human capital, the only way I can think it through, at least, is to get all the kind of mechanisms really lined out. And for that, you need you, you just don't you, that kind of estimator, diff and diff, is not going to give you everything. It'll give you part of what you need. So it's that's the way I tend to think.
So you're not tribal on the methods, but you're are you sort of tribal in the sense of being a committed microeconomist, sort of like, you're tribal in that you love consumer theory and you love that kind of work and see that as like, the things that you really find important.
Yeah, I don't really love theory, by the way. I love addressing problems, and I find consumer, if there's a logical, it's always difficult, isn't it? You don't want to be constrained by a box you've been thinking in, but it kind of helps. Consumer theory, dynamic optimization, all those things help think through the way you I always remember, there's kind of nice comment Steve Nichol made, I think, to me, in fact, but he often says it, is that he's looking at all these investment models, and you kind of think the future and dynamics must matter for investment, and none of them had investment that had those features. And he was kind of talking to Arrow, I think, and Arrow said, oh yeah, but the key thing is, think about irreversibility of capital, of investment. And that's a kind of theoretical point, that if you have irreversibility, the future immediately matters in the decision making, as does history. That kind of insight, that's the way I tend to like to use theory, that it gives you insights that just make a direction for modeling. And then it's into the empirics and getting, of course, good data or a good natural experiment. Those are what matter.
Well, so your work on innovation, I'm not trying to jump around, but I actually did not, I'm still trying to get a handle on who your, by like when people look at Dr. Blundell. And if like, if I walk into a room or if I go to Soli or something like that, and they say, well, this is who Richard Blundell is, how are they bringing all this together? Because even this work like on innovation, I wouldn't, it's not as obvious to me that that has to do with household behavior or consumers, but what am I missing? What's that work been about?
Well, it's not household behavior, but it's a key behavior. That comes, I'm a little bit, I kind of respond, I like to work in teams, by the way. So that early work on innovation was, I had a brilliant PhD student called John Van Reenen, who was, of course, now extremely well known. And a colleague here at UCL at the time was Philippe Aguillon. And we actually, John then, and we had another student called Nicholas Bloom. So Nick Bloom, both incredibly successful students, probably among the most successful I've had. And we were all kind of excited by around the ideas of innovation and investment, and how that might play out. Purely because, that's a key part of just thinking about productivity, which to me, productivity is absolutely kind of fundamental to thinking about how households and incomes evolve. So I really wanted to know about that. And I must say, I hadn't really thought about the way competition works. I wasn't very au fait with Schumpeter and all that. Part of that work was just getting to understand how this idea of you can have too much or too little competition. You want the innovators to innovate, but you don't want them to capture the rents for too long. And the idea is that right? Does the world actually look like that? And so the Inverted U paper with Aguillon and Nick and Rachel Griffiths, who also a colleague at IFS at that time, is really trying to hone in on that. And up till then, it's amazing to say this, but nobody had really taken microeconometrics to that model. And so And it's a model about firm decision making and innovation. And the
Ah.
data was certainly there. We could link up patents with firms, and of course, this is now a very common thing to do, and there are much better models. But I'd still find that very exciting. And of course, in a policy sense, the biggest problem in the UK is that we don't have enough innovation or productivity, so productivity growth. And so I still find that pretty interesting field. Yeah. So I think it's, if you want to ask, there's a set of public policy questions, and then I just, what I like to do is to dive into them with a team of smart people. And so
Yeah,
it's not really households, they're not consumer. It's kind of trying to figure out behavior. But you're right, it's a bit of a kind of checkered career of, if you're trying to nail me as a labor economist or whatever. I was always reluctant here at UCL to have, which I must say was probably the wrong thing, but I always just wanted an applied group, applied micro. I don't want labor, I don't want to have a labor seminar, a public seminar, nothing of that sort, because we have too much to learn from each other. And we still do that, actually.
Yeah.
And it kind of works, but of course there are great, labor economists surely do want to work together, and they have, fantastic insights. But I think, it partly came, from what Angus was doing at the time. Development was in a mess at that time, early, I'm talking about 70s, early 80s. And it was interesting how it had become a mess, because the development seminar, wherever you went, was a very inward-looking thing, with no econometrics, no people jumping around saying that's probably not right, so
Right.
it lacked the excitement of a labor seminar, say. And so, and if you kind of like development, public labor, all those different things, which I do, then bringing them together is a fun thing to do. And I still think that's important, but there's limits to that. But there are, there's now an application seminar at LSE. They didn't used to have that, where that once a week the applied micro group basically get together, because methods in labor are clearly absolutely key to things. They develop faster, but there are methods in IO and development and that are also pretty important, so you can learn from one another.
That's the
Yeah,
first
but
time
that's a
I've.
philosophy, Scott. That's a kind of philosophy, Scott, and it may not be the best one, but it's worked for me anyway.
Yeah, that's the first time I've thought about applied micro being designed almost to bring more conversation between the fields. That's how you've always
Yeah.
thought about it? You've thought about it like that? Is it's like this is a way
Absolutely.
for labor and health to be talking to each other?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh,
Because
that's
remember, when I started in public, labor was a kind of little slight bit of that, and so you could go to a tax seminar, labor income tax, and the view of the labor market was kind of naive, so, and there wasn't much interest in what wage processes look like, how people behaved. Public had one way of doing it, labor had another way. And so I think now you would not see that. I think, there's a lot more interaction, but in my view, not enough. I still think that about labor. I think it can be, I think when we ran the World Congress, here you are, I'm drinking from the Solly, the cup, the mug we did for the Society of Labour Economics conference here, which was the World Conference. I was president of the Society of Labour Economics, which is really North American. Steve Machin, who's my colleague here at that time, was the European one. So we ran the World Congress here, and we tried to make it very diverse. I had Becker, we had, Rob Schirmer, we had, Search, we had families, of course Josh was here, David was here, and we tried to make Pierre Andre about families. So it was, I thought it was brilliant, but I don't know how influential that's been, but I think it's always fun to bring people together like that. You
Yeah.
this limit, you know, some things come from very narrow, intense work. Other things come from bringing people together across the empirical micro.
But that
So.
fits a little bit with you saying that you're not tribal. You know, you're not tribal, so you're kind of like, you know, you're, it sounds like anyway, you're not tribal. You're kind of looking for anything you can learn from anybody.
Yeah,
But then you sort
that's
of
right.
see that as scientifically valuable, and it's your personality. Is that right?
Probably. Yeah,
Huh.
both those. I think it's scientifically valuable. I'm not saying it's the, there are
The only
great
way, right?
scientific instruments that were built off pure tribalism. So,
Right.
it's difficult because, you do get tribal when you think, if I want to address this problem, there's a way of doing it. And there is
Right.
only really one way of doing it. And in that, it might be a, quasi-experimental is the right way. And you don't want all the structure. The question doesn't require that. So why use it? And actually, if you look back at consumer models, where I started, it was horrible because, people would never say what they were actually trying to recover. They'd just estimate something for that sake. So it's being precise about what you want and what you need to do in terms of the methodology or data or theory to be able to do that is the way I like to see it. I still like that. Of course, as you ask for more, you make more assumptions. And there's plenty of people who won't, who don't want to make those assumptions. But that's a trade-off.
Yeah,
If you
sure.
want to, and there's plenty of people who've explored that trade-off much more detail than me. So I won't
Well,
want to.
it's the wrapping up at the, we've been talking for about a little over an hour. I wanted to just
Oh, really? How terrible!
I was just wanted to ask you, well, what is it that really has gotten you out of bed every morning to do this kind of work where, you know, if it, you didn't have that one thing, you know, you just wouldn't even want to be doing this kind of work. What's really been the incentive for you?
Yeah, it's a good question. I'd like to say it's the question I'm trying to answer, and I do think about that. But I must say, the buzz I get is from working with other people and younger, smarter people, and it's still what draws me into this. So, I have great young colleagues here. I work with people elsewhere. And it's the excitement around that. And the pleasure about, in my view, of economics, especially applied economics, has become, the way to do it. You bring people together, it's very exciting, not quite lab-based, which I think can be less exciting. We're talking about three or four people working intensely together. And that's a pretty exciting thing. And if they're very smart, that can be very uplifting and fantastic experience. It might be in a rock and roll band for that matter. I think it's the experience of creating something as a group. And I kind of like that. I kind of like that. So I like that. So it's a combination. It's that plus the question.
You never quit. You never quit your college band. You've just been changing the music and changing the characters out.
Maybe.
Well, it's been so nice to talk to you. I really
Thanks,
appreciate
Scott.
you sitting down with me. I really appreciate it. I hope we can run into each other one day.
Come and drop in London if you're around. We can
Okay, next
explore.
time next time I'm in London, now
That's
you've
great.
invited me, so I'll do
Do that.
it.
Okay.
Okay,
Thanks.
bye-bye.
Great to talk with you. Bye-bye.